Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined with the boss, John Roerink, and Ed Zarpolis from Target Insight. A little later in the program, Tanya Shootmaker, State Senator, will be joining us. I was able to catch up with her behind the Senate chambers during the run-up to the gas tax vote. And speaking about the gas tax vote, Ed, what I found really interesting was the Democrats held together, except for Virgil Smith. Virgil Smith went ahead and voted with the Republicans to support a gas tax increase. Why would he do something like that?
The point being is that I don't sense Virgil. Virgil's looking out for Virgil. He's concerned about what his future might be. And if he gets a vote, which means he may have an opportunity to appease either staying in the Senate or a job down the road. And number two, the Democrats pretty much basically kicked him out of everything as soon as this came down the pike. Took away committee assignments, took a lot of different things.
His staff.
And so the point being is I don't sense Virgil sense any loyalty.
So why not vote with the Republicans if they're going to, if you can ingratiate yourself with them, then maybe you get to stick around the Senate for a little longer.
That is correct. I would say this is self-serving Virgil, Senator Smith himself this time around.
Do you blame him?
No, I don't blame him. I mean, this person right now is at the low end of his life right now. I mean, he's got prosecution, he's got trial, he's got a lot of stuff going on. Like, what does he have to lose? He's got to look for what's best for him down the road.
Well, let's talk about the 2016. We're going to take a look in the Ed Zarpolis crystal ball here. Looking ahead to 2016, there doesn't seem to be a lot, really, for, I guess, anybody to get necessarily excited about outside of presidency. We don't have U.S. Senate. We've got maybe a couple congressional races, but there is only one Supreme Court race and no state Senate, no other state offices. What is this looking like to you?
Well, the point being is we're more looking like this election is going to turn into a 2004 election than it is in 2008 or 2012. I think it'll be better than 2000. I think that there'll be more excitement than there was for the Bush-Gore campaign. I think Hillary will generate some excitement. It's going to be try to maintain the Obama legacy. But the point being is that not everybody's enthralled with Hillary Clinton. Bernie Sanders is making traction even here in Michigan. There is a group of people trying to get him going. So there's not a total love for Hillary Clinton. So she's not going to turn out the urban core vote. So Democrats have to be concerned, and nationally, and including some of the polling shows, the fact that Democrats have a 15-point deficit in interest in voting compared to Republicans. So the point being is this is a presidential year. Yes, Democrats will be turning out in numbers like they already do, but this could be a very, very tough year for Democrats to say that outside of the presidency, can they retain the state house? It's going to be a tough year.
But as far as the nomination, though, you're not concerned that Hillary can't win that nomination.
No, I'm not concerned Hillary can't win the nomination.
It's the general election.
It's the general election of motivating the voters, because right now, the Democrats' only thing ongoing, except for some ballot initiatives, is taking back the House. And, you know, the word on the street is this House Republicans are in disarray, from fundraising to staffing concerns. I hear they just hired a new campaign director. So bottom line, the fact is that, you know, the Democrats have an opportunity to take back the House despite themselves, you know, that type of thing. So if there's no motivation, 2004 seems what may look like here in 2016.
So what would motivate Democratic voters right now? We've heard about putting something on the ballot on the graduated income tax. We've got marijuana. That would seem to get people excited, right, if we can legalize marijuana in Michigan?
Well, first of all, marijuana is not going to change anything in my pocketbook. Okay, it's not going to make me money. It's not going to keep my family food on the table. It's not going to motivate people in the urban core looking for jobs and getting ahead. And marijuana would motivate both sides of the house. There's nothing, when you look, if you're a Democrat or Republican, you want to look, put something in the ballot that motivates your base, not the other guy's base.
Well, what about Elliot Larson? What if they put Elliot Larson civil rights expansion on the ballot to include gays and lesbians?
There again, that'll motivate probably more the not suburban voter, the suburban woman voter, but you still, Democrats need more than just, the more liberal white woman or that type of thing. They need those base votes. They need white males, and they need urban core voters in some of the areas to turn out votes to help them win.
What about prevailing wage? If there's prevailing wage on the ballot, doesn't that get union folks out there to try and, you know, keep prevailing wage as opposed to watch it get repealed?
Okay, now prevailing wage is going to get some balance from both sides of the aisle. Some Republicans support it, and as well as Democrat voters. But the issue here is that that's pretty much focused on the building trades. That's not all union workers. That's not auto workers. and other things. So the point being is that a good issue for some unions, but not all unions.
What else has gotten the urban core voters out before? I mean, they do seem to vote. What kind of thing can we put on the ballot that would get them excited?
The key thing is going to be is how well does Hillary get them motivated to protect their rights and who they are? And I think that's the reason why you see Hillary spending much time with President Obama on his issue of being more progressive. Number two, Republicans have been very sensitive. They've been holding off on totally eliminating the EITC. Okay, now that impacts the urban core voter, you know, because many families there are dependent on that, not the fact that, you know, some of them go from being poverty onto poverty. So basically, it's jobs and things impacting their income. Those are the things that motivate the urban core voter. Now, in the marginal seats, you have to look at what motivates the Democratic male to turn out and vote Democratic. That's the issue that Democrats have to find. You know, when it was Obama, Democratic males voted for him just as much as Democratic women. But we saw in 2012 that some white voters that voted for Obama in a way did not vote for him in 2012. So the issue is going to be, what's going to motivate that white male Democrat to not stay home or not vote Republican? And number two, what's going to motivate the African-American population if they do not feel Hillary is going to protect their interests as Barack Obama did for them?
You mentioned the House Republicans being in disarray, the state House Republicans. Yeah. You see an opportunity here for the Democrats to take majority or get a split.
I mean, with the losses in 2014, that's a lot of seats that Democrats have to make up. And generally, this is not going to be a 2008 election, and unless Hillary Clinton would break 55-56%, the Democrats can pick up seats, but not necessarily take back control. But if what we're hearing on the street, that the House Republicans are a little bit of disarray from staff, people leaving, people being disgruntled, fundraising problems, having to borrow money, then that means the fact that gives the Republicans a little bit of a disadvantage in some marginal seats, because they're not going to be totally have all their acts together. That allows those Democrats with a good candidate to sneak through. So they may probably maybe pick up more seats than they normally would have in a competitive year, even though it's a presidential year.
They have time to correct that, though, right?
Well, they do have time to correct. They have corrected. But the question is how many bad votes did some of their incumbents make that could be used against them? What votes are going to happen between now and the end of the year on road taxes and that type of thing? What's going to happen on candidate recruitment? Are they going to get good candidates to support them? So they can turn this around, but the question is will they?
So it sounds like if they took any type of gas tax increase, that could hurt them?
In their primary, yes.
But in the general election, it wouldn't necessarily...
Not necessarily hurt them generally in the marginal seat. But the question is what the Democrats have to do, then the Democrats have to run against their Democratic base then on this issue, okay, to defeat the Republicans. So if the Republican voted for the tax increase, the Democrats would have to be more run like a Republican then in those marginal seats.
All right, let's move on to other things that would be on the ballot here in 2016. Gretchen Driscoll, how do you think she's doing?
She's working hard. She's all over the place making phone calls, but I've not heard that the money's coming in. We don't hear a lot of talk about major fundraising. You're not talking about major campaign donations, you know, or that type of thing. When you look back under Pam Burns, if you look back at the other races when there's this early out, because remember, this is early out.
Right.
When you jump in this race, there's all stories about how much money they're raising, how much money is coming in, what the DCCC is doing. We don't hear that right now. So Gretchen Driscoll is working hard. She's out there making phone calls, but we're not hearing the gush of dollars coming in.
And you need that because you've got pretty much a full campaign operation going on. To a certain extent, you're fundraising just to keep the operation going.
It's more basic than that. You're not going to get DCCC, Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, support if you don't raise a certain amount of dollars by a certain date. Mm-hmm. So Gretchen's problem, not the fact that she can't go on running and raise money to run next year. She's not going to worry about a primary. The question is, at some point in time, long before April or May of next year, the DCCC will make a decision, are they going to be invested in this race? Mm-hmm. So the point being, if she doesn't make certain financial guidelines of what they expect her to raise, that's where her struggle is going to be. Not the fact that she's not working hard raising money. The question is, will she be in the top 10, top 5, or the top 20? You got to get that at top 10 to really get the money that you need.
So does Lon Johnson running in the first hurt her?
Potentially, yes. Because the issue is going to be, is he showing more traction than her? And if he does, he makes some goals, and yes, his race could move up. Now, you got to remember, typically the first race is where the DCCC always put their attention, not on the 7th. So they were looking at the 7th because Gretchen Driscoll is a woman. It's a Democratic year, typically, that type of thing, but it's very conceived. But the party numbers from redistricting, you and I have talked about this before, Kyle, the 7th design looks to be enticing, but it's really not. So now the first comes into play. If Lon Johnson can show that he can raise the money, And polling shows that he has a chance to win. Because right now, all we've got is Lon Johnson, who owns a cottage, okay, who's getting all the endorsements because no one else is running, and supposedly he has to raise money. There's have no been proof in the pudding yet that that's going to transfer to polling going into next year.
All right, let's move on to 2018. We've talked about the potential candidates for governor quite a bit. How about potential candidates for attorney general? Let's start on the Democratic side.
On the Democratic side, it's going to really come down, does Mark Totten want to run again? Because obviously with Bill Schuette gone, Mark Totten did it. Under all circumstances, he did very good between raising money, organizing, and did a very fine job. The other issue is going to be, if he doesn't run, does Godfrey Dillard, who really wanted to run for attorney general, make that push for that, even though he ran for secretary of state? And then the other person who's in that same scenario is, what does Jocelyn Benson do? Because she can run for secretary of state or AG because of the background. Barring that, then you have to start looking down the totem pole. You have potentially, depending what happens with the Carl Levin's congressional race, you potentially have Senator Beda.
Oh, you mean Sandy Levin.
Excuse me. You got potentially Tim Grimmel, both in that, you know, potentially could for run as attorneys. And I think the biggest name out there that I would say that you'd look at will be a push to encourage County Prosecutor Kim Worthy to run, because they're looking for a woman, they're looking for diversity at the top of the ticket. And she has a strong record. She's been known statewide now for the rape kits. She's got following. She's shown that she can right now raise money.
She put Kwame behind bars.
And the point being, she's taken on the county, trying to keep things safe. So I would say the strongest candidate Democrats have right now, barring the other people, would be Kim Worthy.
What about Gretchen Whitmer?
Gretchen Whitmer reminds me of Cara Malinga from the standpoint, I'm going to do something, then she backs away. The question is she committed? I've heard more talk about her wanting to run for governor if Duggan doesn't run than I hear her run about any other race. The question is where is the money going to come from? Does she have the passion to run?
Let's go to the Republican side on the attorney general race.
I would say that the only word I hear conversations and Republican friends on is Senator Schuttmaker. That's the one that seems to look like it's it.
And I have heard her name as well. I heard a new name this week, last week really, Kevin Cotter.
Kevin Cotter. That's very interesting.
Well, that would be an interesting proposition.
Well, Kevin Cotter's name has come up more from what does he do if he wants to run for Senate. And I would say Kevin Cotter's ability to run for a prosecutor is how does he hold his caucus together between now and next year? Because remember, you're still in a situation, you're going to have that two-year lapse. What does he do to keep his name relevant? And if he loses the House or he doesn't keep the number of seats he has in the House, let's say he doesn't lose the House, that's going to impact whether or not he's going to be able to get the nod to run against Tanya Schuttmaker. Because I'm going to guarantee it, Republicans understand that if the Democrats find a good woman, they're going to want a woman from the Republican side too.
Exactly. And Tanya Schuttmaker brings a bit to the table here. State senator, has been elected to the legislature many times, has won competitive races in the past before.
Yes, she has.
And she's got a tough-on-crime mantra that has been successful with Bill Schuette and Mike Cox before that.
Correctly. And the other thing, bottom line, if you're not coming from the UP or Southeast Michigan, she comes from Southwest Michigan, which was a hidden trove of votes also that crosses into more moderate areas of Calhoun and Battle Creek area, her name's recognition there. So, yeah, she's a very strong candidate right now on paper.
Very good. Ed Zarpolis from Target Insight. Appreciate the time today.
Thank you.
Joining us this week for the podcast, the State Senator Tanya Schuttmaker from Lawton. Thanks for joining us. I appreciate it.
Great to be here.
Now, you have been very active recently on this sexual assault on college campus issue. Tell us how you got involved on this issue with the First Lady.
Well, this is a passion of the First Lady's, and I was happy to have been asked by her, along with my bicameral and bipartisan partners in this, Senator Rebecca Warren, Representative Marilyn Lane, and Representative Laura Cox. And the five of us have been collaborating in terms of what we can do. And the first step was to really hold our first annual summit, which I think we're one of the first states to really kind of get together all the different stakeholders and get together to see how we address campus sexual assault, because it is a problem. We are seeing growing numbers in terms of reporting, but that's probably a good thing because we're encouraging people more to report where it usually was not reported before.
Some of those numbers are a little startling.
They are very startling.
Yeah, I mean, the number of female in particular students who are reporting sexual assaults and then not even reporting them to the police or telling anyone at all. What do you think this commission can do to help address this problem?
Well, first of all, every college campus kind of has different procedures. So one of the things we're looking at in terms of is having a statewide kind of protocol for how people report, how people respond. Sometimes different police departments deal with it differently, and so certainly we're taking a look at that. We're looking how we can be more victim-focused to have different policies and procedures to put more control, whether there's prosecution in terms of the victim's hands, and just overall bringing awareness, which I think anytime you bring awareness to a problem is a good thing.
Is there any legislation on this front that's necessary?
You know, we're still taking a look at that. We heard the summit was an all-day summit, and yeah. it was well received, and so we're taking a look at that, and those are some of the things we're discussing. Other states have had different ways to go about and address it, but sometimes that's not always victim-focused. So we're approaching it with a very cautious way in terms of making sure that all the answers are answered.
Let's change gears here to criminal justice. There's a lot of focus on that right now as far as trying to reduce costs in our prison system. Is trying to thin out our prisons of the folks who are in there the way to go about doing that?
You know, this has been a question that has been reoccurring for the last 11 years that I've been in the legislature. Certainly when I take a look at who's in prison, they're dangerous felons. So I certainly usually side with the prosecutors in that it's very difficult to get to prison, and the people that we have locked up really deserve to be in prison. I practice criminal court appointments for the first year I was an attorney. I actually only had a few people go to prison. I had one guy that slid a lady from ear to ear. By the grace of God, she lived, but he was charged with attempted murder and pled to that. He actually only got 7 years for that crime. So I think our criminal justice system is very fair, and so I would usually not support lessening any sentencing guidelines.
Now, how do we tackle these correctional costs? So it's $2 billion in the budget. Seems like they've been stabilized, but it seems like our costs per prisoner are higher than those of other states. Is there something we can do?
Certainly it's, we did have a large overtime problem. I think Senator Prose has done a very good job at getting a lot of those ancillary costs down in terms of the labor. But certainly it's important that we also don't keep our eye off of public safety. And I think if you let out dangerous prisoners, I think if you look at our prison population, you know, at a high, I think we had about 56,000 prisoners. Now that's down to 45,000 prisoners. Certainly the root cause of why we have people in prisons is we have dangerous crime rates in our cities. And certainly taking more of a holistic approach in terms of addressing crime from the outset and having strong families and strong communities is something that I've always supported, so that you do it on the front end and not the back.
Now, there's always been this argument out there from those who would like to support some type of scaling back of the folks who are in prison, that if they've already served their minimum sentence, what's wrong with getting them in front of the parole board? And if they're doing fine in prison, they serve their minimum, go ahead and let them out.
You know, that's why we have a parole board, and usually the parole board, acts judiciously. But, I'm very hesitant to let the dangerous felons, because I know how hard it is to get to prison in the first place, and usually the people that we have locked up are people that people do not want back in their communities. They're sex offenders, they're criminals, and that are repeat offenders. And so certainly I take it more from the victim's rights standpoint of letting people out of prisons, and would like to explore other ways to reduce costs in our correction system.
Why is that a passion for you?
It's a passion. I've always felt strongly in terms of victims' rights, and just feel that we need to make sure that we do all we can to protect people out in our communities.
What would you like to see this legislature do for the rest of the year?
Well, certainly we'll be tackling road funding, hopefully,
right.
This summer. We've done a great job in terms of budget balancing. This is the fifth year in a row where we've put out a balanced budget, not only on time but also early. So I think our accomplishments in terms of reforming government is certainly has been on the right path, and I'd like to continue with that.
Obviously, as part of this budget and as part of the roads, we've talked a lot about some type of revenue increase, gas tax increase. What is the criteria for you to approve any type of
tax increase? Because obviously that's a hard vote.
It is a very difficult vote, but the one thing I did hear from voters that went to Proposal 1 is they had several criteria in terms of making sure that it was more user fee based, that first of all, the legislature take a look at their own budget and make certain cuts. What I do like about the Senate proposal that is going on right now that we'll be debating later is that it does make certain cuts. It does put the onus on the legislature to find revenue and squeeze every dollar out of state government. And so they also want all the money to go to the roads. And that's another thing. I think Proposal 1, one of the reasons it did go down so soundly is that I heard people saying, well, it doesn't all go to the roads. I'd vote for something if it all went to the roads.
And that's the thing with any type of gas tax increase. If it goes to the roads, then that's something you could be comfortable with.
It probably is something that I can be comfortable with. I sit on appropriations, and I've not been able to come up with $1.2 billion, which is the widely accepted number. Even the Mackinac Center supports a $1.2 billion in terms of what it costs for additionally for our roads. So I think that's a realistic number. When, you know, we've eliminated film tax credits, we've trimmed a lot. And so when it comes to this, this is something that is user fee-based in nature. It makes cuts to our general fund budget in the year 17, and is probably something that I'll look forward to supporting.
Now, you mentioned appropriations, and part of the discussion has been making $700 million in cuts. Does that get you a little like, oh my God, how are we going to do this?
Well, we've got a good year. You know, a lot of people, a lot of my colleagues have said they'd rather focus on the cut side rather than the revenue side. So we have our work and our challenge cut out for us in the next year.
Now, I noticed you at the Ted Cruz presidential event. I know you have not endorsed. I know you haven't endorsed him, but can we expect to see you at more of these kind of Republican Party events in the future?
One of the great things is we've got a great presidential field, so I look forward to hearing all the presidential candidates out there speaking.
So is this part of you doing your research, or are you just making yourself a bit more visible these days?
Well, it's a great state, and I like to visit the state.
I like to visit the state, too, and I like seeing you at these events. Tanya Shoemaker, State Senator, thanks for joining us on the program.
Thank you. Great to be here.
All right, that's going to do it for this week's edition of MERS Monday. Thanks to Ed and Tanya Shoemaker and the boss, John Rurink, and also thanks to our friends at the Michigan Press Association. Until next week, I'm Kyle Mullen. Take care.